This is Place Matters, a podcast at the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to Season 6, Voices from the Field, where we speak with historians, researchers, authors, and thought leaders whose work is shaping the field of place-based development. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting for FCS and the host for Place Matters. A corrosive myth in American culture is that black and brown communities, especially ones that are low income, are personally responsible for these conditions. But for over 45 years, FCS has seen up close and personal over and again how untrue that is and how dangerous it is to perpetuate this way of thinking. What is needed is a more robust understanding of the factors and the forces that have created such yawning disparities. We need to see not only how racialized practices of the past created these inequalities, but how present actions are deepening and perpetuating them. Here today to help us wrestle with these realities is Dr. Andre Perry, a senior fellow at Brookings Metro, a scholar in residence at American University, and a professor of practice of economics at Washington University. Dr. Perry is nationally known and respected commentator on race, structural inequality, and education. His research has revealed that there is a $164 billion disparity in the value placed on black assets versus white ones. So listen in as we discuss this research and more from his book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities. Andre, thank you so much for making time to join us in this conversation. I'm super excited to dialogue about your research and the work in your book. But before we get into that, I'm always curious about what got people into this work kind of at a personal level. Like, even though you're a brilliant researcher and writer and doing a lot of really high-level work, normally it's something personal that prompts people to want to give their professional interest to this level of work. So for you, what was it that made you want to go down this path and do this kind of work?
Well, as I write in my book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities, a lot of my work is really rooted in how I was raised. I was born in a small black, or actually born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but raised in a small black majority municipality called Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, which is surrounded by Pittsburgh on three sides. And as the story was told to me, I was informally adopted by this older woman in the hood who took in kids. My mother was under duress. My father was a heroin addict, and he was murdered in prison. When I was about eight, but I didn't know him, but this woman I call mom, her name is Elsie Boyd, took me in, and she reared me in this house that was owned actually by her son, I'm assuming through the GI Bill, but she reared me and numerous other children throughout my time there. I was from birth to I graduated from high school, and the other kids, some would stay a few weeks, some would come on a daily basis, some would stay a few months. I would stay from birth to graduation along with my brothers. And but a lot of this work on housing devaluation started with me going back to that home years later and discovering that it was only valued about $13,000 at the time. Oh, wow. Looking across other neighborhoods, I was like, this can't possibly be true. And so I started really measuring the value of that home in relation to homes in white neighborhoods. But still at my core, what I learned from that is that experience is that we are brothers and sisters, not necessarily by blood, but through the work through our relationships that we have, civic brothers and sisters, the people that grew up in that house, developed a bond that I think I translate into bonds that go beyond bloodline. So for me, this work is really about increasing family, giving people the stability of a good home, a good community, and doing what it takes. And that often means removing these drags of racism from what we do.
Yeah, you're, so my team and I, you know, do a lot of research and in neighborhood work and inequities in our cities, and just that's the nature of the work that we do. And your book in particular, like deeply researched, you know, but at the same time, you're like that level of this is a part of the part of who I am and the way that I see the world was clear throughout. There was a one of my favorite quotes in your book was where you said that Black people's communities, their loving networks, are our most powerful assets, and to like, and how you start with your story and then like you're unfolding kind of this national narrative. Like, I never felt the data of the national story, I never felt like it was disconnected from like you and your personal kind of life, and it just was profound to walk through that. So I appreciate you sharing it from both that kind of academic side, but also just that lived reality side. It was very powerful to experience that.
Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. And my mother thanks you and everything. Yeah. That's the point of this book. I mean, people can read the reports, the data. They can go to brookings.edu to read all my sort of statistical analyses. But if you want to get the story behind the data, you can see the people behind the data, that's what I hope this book provides.
Well, in the book, you mentioned the difference in value of Black homes versus white homes. And so comparing like to like, you know, similar neighborhoods, similar housing types, similar amenities in the area, the difference between those home values is at $156 billion, averaging out at about $48,000 per home difference. So I want to kind of put that in the mind of our listeners and kind of frame our conversation around, okay, so how do we, like, that wasn't an accident, right, that we got there. That's not just like someone forgot to carry a one. That's a substantive, systemic, nationwide reality. So I want to talk about how did we get there, and what is the impact of this beyond just like people's houses being valued less? There's a bigger story at that. And then, you know, try to move towards what can we do? What are we doing that's not working? What can we be doing that could work? So starting off with some causes, you know, how did we get here? One of the things we say on our team is like our neighborhoods are working perfectly, meaning they were designed to do exactly what they're doing, that decisions were made to create the inequitable situations that we're in. So how did we get to this place where the valuation of home assets are so wildly divergent?
Well, there's a lot of reasons why homes in Black neighborhoods are underpriced. Now, I just want to give the listeners a little statistical backing for this, that we, in our pursuit of understanding value, we looked at the average list price of homes in Black neighborhoods and compared them to neighborhoods where the share of the Black population was 1%. So majority Black, 50% compared to places where there are few Black people. And before controlling or attending to various characteristics, homes in Black neighborhoods are underpriced by more than 50%. And a lot of people will say that's because of education, that's because of crime. But those are things you can control for in a study, and that's what we did. So we controlled for education, crime, walkability, all those fancy Zillow metrics, and as we did, what we come up with was that about $156 billion in lost equity, $48,000 per home, about 23% difference still after after controlling for those things. So, but the reason for it is multifold. It's, you know, remember throughout history, we had everything from redlining, where federally Federally backed homeowners loan corporation drew red lines around predominantly black neighborhoods, determining them unworthy of various federal investments. You have the unfulfilled promises of urban renewal. You have predatory lending. Everything from white flight to a number of issues, but all of those things play a role now. But we do know that there are some practices and policies that are very impactful. A lot of people have piled on appraising. I will say this, that in appraisers, now there's certainly discrimination and bias on the part of the appraiser. We see this where homeowners in seeking to get a refinancing, they get an appraisal and they get a sense that they're being lowballed, and then what they do is pretty ingenious, but it's been done throughout the history of black home ownership. Upon learning that they're being lowballed, they get a second appraisal. This time they remove all the black books, art, clothing, hair products, lotions, and then replace it with white facing ones. And oftentimes that the second appraisal comes back significantly higher in Marin County, 500,000, Baltimore, 300,000. I mean, there's a number of stories throughout. But those are acts of individual bias, right? I say this, it's less appraisers and more appraising. That the price comparison approach, where you compare one home to another to get an average list price, is fraught, because if you compare one home to another in a neighborhood that's been discriminated against, you effectively recycle the discrimination over and over again. That takes discrimination at a scale. We have, because of our work, gotten the appraisal data. One thing I'm very proud of, partly because of our work, the Federal Housing Finance Agency released appraisal data so that we can actually measure how much appraising matters, and we found that low appraisals that come under the contract price is twice as likely to happen in black majority neighborhoods. And when they do, they come up significantly lower than in white neighborhoods. So those bad appraisals account for about 20% of that appraisal gap. So there's a lot more things at play. So there are a lot of reasons for the appraisal gap, and that's why we do the research. We first we started off with appraising. Now we're looking at other areas, and we're just taking small bites of that elephant to account for the variance. And
I think what's like part of why our team has found your work so valuable is that so even with the people who would agree with the data of racial disparities, because somehow some people don't even agree that it's real, but even though it's like, yes, it's very real, the wealth gap, the value gap, and if you like, when you start kind of picking at how they understand the gap that's there, it's often framed in terms of like legacy of redlining or legacy of block, but like things that happened like pre-Fair Housing Act or whatever, or in terms of like just some interpersonal racism that still exists, where they kind of like, there's an assumption that like in 1968 we fixed the like systemic side of it all, and now we're just trying to clean up after it all, but like what you're speaking into is like they're ongoing still today, 2024, like policies and systemic things going on that aren't just about interpersonal biases that are keeping
black and brown neighborhoods devalued or disinvested in. So like, what are some of the things that you've been talking about and looking at that are not just legacy of past actions, which is true, but there's ongoing actions that we have to be paying attention to as well?
Well, I mean, some of the things I think are most important, not just in terms of home value, but in terms of just throttling wealth creation among black people in majority black communities. Certainly, I mentioned our appraisal practices are one of them. But we are just now updating our credit scoring systems and how we apply credit scores. You know, we have so many what we call invisible prime borrowers, people who do everything right. But because black people are much less likely to receive an intergenerational wealth transfer, many of those potential home buyers can't purchase a home because they don't have the down payment. So we need to create new products that really align with those potential consumers and potential home buyers. But we don't create products around people who don't have wealth. We don't when it's not a white emergency. So we really just need to create products for everyone who have showed the ability that they can pay their bills on time. And regardless of your wealth. And so the credit agencies as well as your government sponsored enterprises or sort of Freddie and Fannies of the world are making changes. Not that long ago, Freddie and Fannie started incorporating rental payments into their underwriting practices, which is absolutely phenomenal because now these lenders can essentially expand their special purpose credit programs, programs that were designed to provide different types of products. But now they can really expand them because these creative loans can now be sold on the secondary market because the underwriting standards are changed. And then, you know, that's a lot of policy wonky stuff to say that if you change the way we measure credit scores, which historically did not account for the discrimination in wealth distribution. So if we can create new credit scores, we can really change the game. So appraising, credit scoring, new mortgage products, these are the kind of things that we need to implement and change because we can, whittle away at the wealth gap, but we need to do a lot of other things. And I need to be clear about this. It's not just about housing. Obviously, if we still have employment and wage discrimination, it's always going to be hard to get a home for many people. So we shouldn't just forget about all these other things that impact the community. But I do focus on homes. I do focus on education.
I'd love to get into that 156 billion number, though it measures a very specific thing about a very specific asset like homes, it is not just about that, right? That is a statistical doorway into a national systemic reality where, you mentioned that, devaluing black property is just another iteration of devaluing black people and black assets of all kinds. So how would you say, whether it be education or wages or other things, what are some of the cascading results or factors that are go around that? It's not just about, hey, your house is worth 23% less than the white guy's house in a neighborhood adjacent to you. Like, that's a big deal, but that's not the only deal we're talking about in this.
Yeah, I always put that $156 billion in context. Because it sounds like a big number, but we throw around the billion number all the time. But what does that actually mean? So 156 billion is the equivalent of more than 4 million black-owned businesses based upon the average amount black people use to start their firms. It would have paid for more than 8 million four-year degrees based upon the average amount of four-year public education. It would replace the pipes in Flint, Michigan 3,000 times over. Is more than double the annual economic burden of the opioid crisis. So it's a big number. And I say that last point of the double the economic burden of the opioid crisis. So because when it comes to my father, who was a heroin addict, who died in prison, who I mentioned that earlier, that if he lived in a neighborhood in which the home values were accurate, he would have had greater opportunity to start a business, a greater opportunity to go to college. His schools would have been better resourced. His drug addiction probably would not be criminalized. Mm-hmm. His life and my life would have been fundamentally different. And that's why I say all the time, like it keeps my teeth white, that there's nothing wrong with black people that ending racism can't solve. That when things go wrong in black communities, we blame black people. We don't look at the systemic practices and policies that extract wealth and opportunity that, you know, that do have an impact on life outcomes. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no question that wealth is correlated with a number of behaviors. When you have lower wealth, you have different marital outcomes, different crime outcomes, different educational outcomes. And so I would never sidestep the things that are happening on communities, but in communities that are deleterious value and everything else. But if you really want to change that situation, you got to go for root causes. And so we need to figure out ways to restore the wealth and value that's been extracted by racism. That's the human development fuel that can really increase economic mobility and well-being.
Yeah, and the thing that is we'll just say infuriating is that the things that you just described are so often told in the other causation factor about, like, well, if you didn't do these things, you'd be wealthy, right? That, like, we're looking at the lack of wealth as a result of these behaviors or these actions. And so we, systemically create the conditions, then we create the narrative that blames you for those conditions, which only continues to perpetuate them, from whether it's appraising or redlining or zoning or whatever it or policing, whatever it becomes, is that we take result and make it the cause, where we just kind of further stigmatize the black family, the black neighborhood, versus saying, like, no, these are conditions that have been created that are leading to these life outcomes, versus the reverse of that.
Yeah, you know, it's a point I always remind people that education does not predict for wealth. Wealth predicts for education.
Yeah,
But I always refer to one of my favorite quotes, comes from Thich Nhat Hanh, who said, he recently died maybe a few years ago, if you're growing a head of lettuce and the lettuce isn't growing, you don't blame the lettuce. You look to see if the soil's enriched. You look to see if it's getting proper rainwater. You look to see if it's getting sunlight. You'd never blame the lettuce. When things go wrong in black communities, we blame black people. When things go wrong in black schools, we blame black teachers. When things go wrong in our neighborhoods, we say, look at them, pull your pants up. We don't look at, you know, the things that are causing the soil not to to be enriched. But for me, I do my work, I try my best not to blame the lettuce.
Yeah.
I try to look at upstream approaches to what's going on.
Yeah, I feel like that metaphor describes why my team gets up and goes to work every day, is that there's I feel like the history of cities and neighborhoods and development is just painfully repetitive, in that harm keeps being done too, and then the second layer of harm is the blame then lands upon the Black community, the Black neighborhood, and always that cycle of systemic harm followed by, well, we're going to blame you for the conditions that have been created to harm you, and being able to and our work is that, let's look at the soil. So FCS's work is about neighborhood-based work. You mentioned the book that I think quote by David Williams about, your zip code determines your health more than your genetic code. That's where we live day in and day out, is that the effective neighborhood so profoundly determines how long you live, how many trips your child is going to have to the ER because of asthma. All of this is so shaped by place. And so you're leaning into house values as a way to kind of bring about that conversation is so powerful. Can we ask questions about the soil, right? And can we reframe what we're investing to ensure that the health is coming out of it, because neighborhood, whatever conditions are there, have been produced by the systems that have been built to make them, right? And to be able to ask those broader questions about the soil effect, that's at the heart of why we're here.
Absolutely. If we don't start looking at sort of preconditions, What are the preconditions to these things that we don't like? And I think, I take a very clear-eyed view around a lot of these matters. There are behaviors, there are things happening in communities that we cannot avoid.
Yeah.
That to turn a blind eye to them and only look at structures, it would be doing ourselves a disservice. But the issue is, if we really are interested in transforming our community, if we truly are genuinely trying to improve conditions, you don't browbeat people. Mm-hmm. You get to these preconditions. Mm-hmm. And that is an appropriate response. Otherwise, all you're doing is waving your finger. And that's not policy. When you work on preconditions, you're really working on policy. Mm-hmm. You're really looking at changing conditions at a scale that can actually transform communities. If I want to browbeat an individual and hope that they'll change, that's one thing. That's something I'll do to my son. If I want to transform a community, I work on policy.
Yeah.
So we just need to get that right. It's too much finger wagging.
Yep.
And it comes from policymakers, comedians, artists, you name it. And it's just a cultural blame that has to stop.
Hey guys. If you're feeling challenged by these conversations in our Voices from the Field series and are wondering how to address these realities in your own neighborhood, please reach out to us. We would love to bring FCS's experience to your neighborhood. Place-based work is complex and multifaceted, so don't go at it alone. Whether it's some one-on-one coaching or walking with us through our 2-year multi-sector cohort called City Shapers, we're here for you, so reach out to us today at fcsministries.org.
And I'm with this. None of this is an effort to say humans are just robots that don't have agency or choice. Absolutely, there's nothing about what we're saying. Actually, the method of reweaving neighborhoods is about personal agency and voice and power and engagement. We're all in on that, but neighborhoods are going to function the way we design them to function, but to only blame the people who are there misses the idea of our structures, right? Yeah. And being able to, we're doing a leadership training just the other day on the social cohesion nature of neighborhoods, and as we're describing high social cohesion versus low, part of what we were inviting the leaders to do is to say, well, what are the preconditions that allow this neighborhood to have a lot of social vibrancy and connection and this one to feel isolated? Because it's not just because the people in this neighborhood are nicer and they choose to like their neighbors, and this neighborhood, these people are just somehow all collectively rude and they want to avoid their neighbors. Like, what are the neighborhood conditions that promote like safety and connectivity and culture and vibrance and cooking outside and playing music? Like, There are factors other than just individual choice at play. And how are we, and again, it's a soil thing, like how are we creating the kind of soil that would grow the fruits of connection and belonging? You know, one of the fruits of sorts that you talk about is like the health disparities side, especially around infant health, maternal health. Why for you is that one of the more significant things to look at when really seeing the impact of this devaluation that we're talking about?
Well, on a couple fronts. So a lot of my work looks at life expectancy, broadly speaking. And the reason why I look at that is because ultimately that's how these conditions, if we're improving, we're going to improve life expectancy ultimately. Mm-hmm. So I try to measure life expectancy, and no surprise that we do find that there are areas where life expectancy is high and where life expectancy are low. And we also find that there's lots of civic action underneath those differences. And we also see that there's a lot of policy throttling growth in that regard. But it's also near and dear to my heart because my personal life, we struggled to have a child when trying to conceive, and a lot of that was because of the duress that my wife at the time was under, and I saw firsthand how Black women who are educated, well-resourced, still have outcomes as if they were low income, lived in impoverished neighborhoods. And so that's when I learned that you can't educate or buy your way to better health disparities if you're a Black woman, or better birthing outcomes if you're a Black woman. And so racism plays a role in that. And so if we are very interested in, and this goes for men and women, if we are really interested in improving those kind of outcomes, we do need to have healthy conversations about the role racism and sexism plays in our community. And those are the kind of conversations I think that can actually unify us. We even in our conversation around racial justice, we don't find a unifying sort of voice. We kind of say it's all this or all that.
Yep.
And a lot of this, and this is my personal belief, it's a community thing. That we share a fate. We certainly deal with these outcomes differently. Men, women, Black, white, Latino, Asian, and this is not Pollyannish. We do share a fate. We have to go in this together, humbly, with an ethic of understanding and trying to learn, with humility, everyone. And that we just are not used to working together across racial, gender, socioeconomic lines, and we have to. I'm very passionate about that. We're not going to do it alone. There's no, and we're not going to. And this might sound a little controversial, but we can't play oppression Olympics too much. We don't see our interconnectedness. Many people are suffering, and certainly there's degrees to suffering, but suffering is suffering, and we have got to see that we can all do better if we all contribute to a just society. And that, mm-hmm. for me, that we have to do that.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, if I hop on a boat that's got a hole in it and it's, you know, water's gaining, I'm not going to be like, not my boat. I didn't put the hole in it. Yeah, you know, it's right, like, well, we're on it now. So like, we're all either going to, you know, do well together or harm together. And I think that's the piece where you know, just like, this is certainly about Black neighborhoods, but this is about all of us, right? This is about the society we're choosing to live in. And that the, like, raising my kids in this neighborhood, to say, like, all of our kids, their well-being is bound up together. And I could try to grab me in mine and run off into my white haven and build my walls of wealth, but like, I will still be harmed by that. That we are better off in this, like, fully and together, is such a, yeah, it's such that kind of call to the solidarity dividend, as it were, right? To see our own well-being in each other's, and this isn't just a your group's issue versus that group's issue. This is all of us. This is our community being bound up in this. You know, I want to talk a little bit about what are some efforts that are not working to move the needle to close the equity gap. But one of them in particular is the way that you reframe how we talk about equity, because the most common way of thinking about it is like, this is what the white individual, the white family, the white community has versus the Black family or community. And then we're going to measure the distance between those and say, well, that's the equity gap. And you're articulating that that's a way of continuing to center whiteness in our measures. And there's a better way to think about equity and wealth and what we're shooting for. So what is problematic about that particular type of thinking about equity? What is a better frame for how we think about it?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's necessarily a better frame. All these things are useful. We do need to do racial disparity work to get crude mm-hmm. measures of where we are totally. But when you oftentimes, one, when you look at comparisons between Black and white people at the national level, you really mask the gains that are happening mm-hmm. at a local level and within subgroups. But then theoretically, when you're always comparing Black people to white people, there's an assumption that Black people just need to catch up to white people in order mm-hmm. for there to be justice. And so I avoid a lot of that and by essentially measuring Black people to Black people and looking for growth, looking mm-hmm. for their strength, looking for the differences, because the assumption is that if Black people are doing well here, you know, and they're dealing with similar structures, mm-hmm. what did they do to hopefully dismantle some of those structures? Mm-hmm. So I look for that. A lot of my research starts by looking for strength, mm-hmm. looking where people are doing well.
Yeah.
And starting from that basis. And mm-hmm. then once I find, well, people are doing well, I can see, oh, there was some action taken around this particular strategy. And then I work backwards from that. So some of this is just from a research perspective, not falling in a trap of just always looking at racial disparities.
Yeah.
Always assuming that, you know, Black people are doing bad and people are doing better. It's really to examine intra-racial dynamics to see differences there. But, all, you know, I use all of the tools at my disposal, but there often are tools that we never go to, and they are just as valuable, if not more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I appreciate that so much, as I think in our community development work, we, like you, we try to counter the deficit perspective, which drives so much of the conversation. And there's always this tension we're dealing with of like, we need to speak honestly and accurately about where we are and where things are, but it can become really easy, me and my team included, to like be so hyper aware of the disparities that that becomes the only story we're thinking about, right?
That's right.
And so we begin to kind of over conflate like concentrated disadvantaged neighborhoods and some of these social ills and challenges with this is quote the Black experience. So we've now isolated all struggle's the only story, right? Versus being, again, to your point, like Black people's communities, their networks, these are powerful assets, and being able to, like, both are true and both should be faced, right? And that as we think about any path forward cannot be framed from that deficit perspective, that it's got to be something different.
And I take a very, this might sound sophomoric, but you always have to start with strength. Now, if you're truly interested in building and changing communities, you got to start with community strength. You look for, oh, business development is good in this community. Let's start there. Because when you lead with deficit, investments generally go towards people fixing the deficit. When you lead with strength, investment goes toward the strength. So I'm always like trying to put the strength as the lead as a way to tell an investment story.
And how do we do that? How do we do that well? I think like another one of the tensions is like advocating for more investment in Black and brown communities that have been for generations disinvested from, right, and harmed. But there's an immediate tension of like, is that investment going to lead to displacement or other harmful factors in a neighborhood? So in your work, your research, you talk about the need for this investment. How do we do that in ways that are responsible and healthy, not deficit driven, right? Not investing in the wrong kind of places. How do we do that investment well?
Well, I have a couple of responses to that. We actually just released a report. I'm blanking on the title, but it's how to we examined the neighborhood investments in the Livernois 6 Mile neighborhood of Detroit.
Okay. Yeah.
And we found that there has been sizable investments in that area, but not much displacement. At least the racial demographics have not shifted dramatically. We're finding that in general, that the investments are going to actually people in the neighborhood. So you can actually invest in developers from that live in the neighborhood. You can actually invest in the business owners that live in the neighborhood. The point being is that if there is a framework for investment, you have to invest in people first. If you invest the second thing, people, places, and divest in racism. So if you invest in place, brick and mortar, you'll raise values and people won't keep pace. So you got to figure out ways to invest in people. So that they are the principal benefactors of investment. That way they can keep pace with inevitable cost of living increases that come along with investment. And then, you know, and also you have to invest in a scale that doesn't shock the community. Now that might sound like you have to be iterative and slow, but you do want people to stay. That's what I mean. Community development assumes you're developing the community.
Yes.
And too often our actions is more developing the brick and mortar, not the people in it. And then finally, you invest in people. You do need to invest in place. You do need to invest in brick and mortar, just not the expense of people. But then finally, you need to divest from racism. If you don't remove these policies that extract wealth, you'll find yourself quickly back in the same situation you were in. So that's the overall strategy: invest in people, invest in place, divest from racism.
And I love your emphasis on like co-creating with Black neighborhoods. The way that you kind of double click the emphasis on the word community and community development. So I kind of find myself like standing on a chair with those parts of your book, because in our work, we're in conversations with a lot of place-based practitioners. And because the level of investment that needs to happen is so significant, and a lot of the challenges are so urgent, and the conversation quickly becomes like all the really big bricks and sticks and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, there's people too, right? Where are the neighbors? Like where are the people who live here? That those individuals are the greatest asset, and to not see that as some sort of just, you know, emotive heart thing from the caring little nonprofit that cares about the people versus the development. It's like, no, like sociologically, scientifically, if you don't involve the people and live into the agency of those networks, your development is going to fail, right?
Right.
And how we do this work, like in, with, alongside, and to co-create. I love that emphasis that you have. One of the things you also emphasize is the importance of Black women in leadership. Talk about why that is such a crucial part of moving the needle on this.
I mean, I partly discussed it earlier. We have to work across gender lines and racial lines, and Black women are contribute significantly to our growth, and they were worthy of investment. You know, and so throughout the book, I identify the people and ideas that are essentially devalued. Just like our homes are much more valuable than they are priced, we have people and systems that are in place are much more valuable than they are priced. So when we see their actual value, we would be investing in them more. So we should be investing in political leadership of Black women. We should be investing in leadership of Black women overall, because they're worthy of investment.
And one final question. There's a metaphor towards the end of the book that you use that I have found very beautiful, and would love for you to kind of give context story around it. You talk about the desire for your scholarship to be a part of the drumbeat of the demonstration. So connect that for our listeners to what you mean by your scholarship being a part of the drumbeat of the demonstration.
Oh, I mean, we all... we have to see ourselves as part of a movement. That, you know, I like to think that I'm handsome and smart and charismatic and I can just wave my magic wand and get people to follow. No, you have to be a part of a movement. Part of the problem is in society right now is that we look to celebrity. We look for someone to lead us. We adore the person with the most followers. And that goes across the board. Liberal, conservative, you know, there's always some thing that we follow. And we've equated sort of exposure with success. And we should be looking at movement and cooperation and community as the standard. It's okay to be a part, to play your part. And we all should play our part. And so for me, it's, I just want my research to be a part, you know, not some kind of, you know, I don't want to be like a talking head all the time, you know, and look at me, look at what I'm doing. Because the reality is that I have a team of researchers that are also committed to this work. In particular, my writing partner, Jonathan Rothwell, has been with me since the beginning of this devaluation work. I have a number of research assistants. but I also work across institutional lines. I partner with Derek Hamilton of the New School, does great work, researchers all over the country. I'm just a part, and right now I have a little bit of a stage. My goal is to share that stage and to advance the work. Yeah. And so, so that's what it means.
I love it. And I just appreciate the kind of the bookending of your book, of like starting with your own story and your mom and your neighborhood and all the beauty that is, and like ending with this idea of like a little bit of demonstration of people in the streets who are like unifying for justice and liberty and freedom together. And like you're hearing the music of that drum beat, and for you to like attach the idea of scholarship, which doesn't often feel human or communal or vibrant or musical, you know, but to say like, hey, this is like, we do this work, whether we're building school buildings or putting in infrastructure in neighborhoods or a writing scholarship, or we're doing an after school tutoring program, like this needs to be a part of a movement. It should be musical. It should be human. And I just appreciate that you invite us into something that is about people, about their loving communities and the assets that human beings are. Your work has impacted me and my team and those that my team gets to work with. So Dr. Perry, thank you so much for the work that you're doing, and also for being so generous with your time today to be in this conversation.
Hey, thanks for having me, and good luck with this podcast. Yeah. I hope I didn't fumble around too much.
No, it's been great. Thank you so much.
If you have benefited from this conversation, I would encourage you to pick up Dr. Perry's book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and Property in America's Black Cities, wherever books are sold. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission it is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you would like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in the show notes. If you would like to watch these episodes, the videos can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you like this episode, please share it on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rhodes with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park, Becca Klein, and Rose Silva at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. We would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment, Inc., whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.